two or three first downs the whole game.
Yeah, it's been a rough night for the Black Shirts.
Ball in the middle of the field, 24, first and 10. Single receivers, pistol formation. Another running back, this time to the left, but he cuts to the right.
He's got some room. Oh,
big room, and finally brought down at the 9. Another first down. Actually, they're calling it the 10. But it should be first and goal.
Wrapped up by number 6, Seth Lascano.
Seth Lascano in the game now for the Black Shirts. Good to see him back. I know he was shaken up, I think, in the first game of the season, I believe it was. Ball in the right hash, single receivers, pistol formation again, and Colton Lynch in the game now for Muck. Low snap, Lynch gets it though. Big hole up the middle, and he fights. Oh, great shoestring tackle there by number 30, Joel Torres. 4:54 and counting. So this will make it second and one for Muck. Will likely be breaking 50 here.
We've got a penalty flag.
There is a flag down, though. Let's see what that's all about. Yeah. Muck is walking backwards, so that could be encouraging. And maybe a holding call here. Yep, they're
that
marking it back. This could be a personal foul based on how far they're pushing it back. That's
yeah,
all the way
want.
To the 20. Well, no, it could be just holding right at the line because the ball is at the 10. All right, well, Muck's ready to go. They're not shaking up. Single receivers, pistol formation with Colton Lynch back in for Cool. It's Colton Lynch going to the right side. Pushes, no, they finally, Black Shirts put a decent little stop on him.
27.
Gets about 5 yards there, so.
Wrapped up by 16, Jimenez.
Ben Jimenez still playing both ways.
16, Ramon Jackson.
Oh, no, Ramon Jackson made the tackle. Sorry about that. Menace is on the sideline. So that makes it 2nd and 16. Second and goal, actually. Low snap. They go to Lynch again on the left. He's got a hole.
He's got some room.
Breaks one tackle. He's trying to get around the outside. Pushes one corner out of the way. Gets all the way to like the 4. Some beautiful running there. He did a Heisman in that one corner.
Did.
Pushed good, really good technique there. Justin Geezy finally got him down. Clock running, 3:07 and counting here in the game. There could be another penalty here. Face mask against the defense. So with the
Ouch.
Ball, well, the ball already spotted at like the 4. That's probably going to put him at the 2.
2 minutes, 50 seconds left.
And counting, so game can't end soon enough for the Black Shirts. Ball on the left hash. Power eye formation here. No, I'm sorry, pistol formation. Another low snap, but not an issue. He fights his way in, and another touchdown for Muck. I think that's Cole Oldenburg. I think that's his second of the night. So it's quite an arsenal of tailbacks Muck has, in addition to a very strong O-line. So they've got a lot to look forward to in the rest of this young season as they move to 4-0. Clock has stopped here, interestingly enough, for the extra point. I guess they do that with even the slaughter roll. Kuhl is holding for Huebner. Noah Huebner. Jaden Kuhl. This will make it 56 if it goes through. Snap the kick. And
no good.
It misses wide to the left.
No good.
Huh. That was a short kick, too. He hooked it.
226 in the game.
So 55-0 with 2:26 left. And we'll take a quick 30-second break here in the Black Shirt Football Radio Network. Anya, take it away.
If you've been searching for authentic, made-from-scratch American Italian cuisine, visit Mia's of Waukesha. Mia's skilled chefs craft every dish with freshness and love, bringing you the true essence and flavor of American Italian classics. Open daily Wednesday through Sunday at 800 Clinton Street in Waukesha. Walk in or call to reserve a table. 262-547-6503. That's 262-547-6503. Or log on miasofwaukesha.com.
Hanging around.
Yeah. Welcome back to your Waukesha South coverage. This is Don and Johnny.
Thank you, Anya. And with 2:26 remaining in the game, McGonigal will kick off. After scoring their eighth touchdown, they missed the extra point. Noah Huebner will be kicking off. And again, it's DeWalton Williams back to receive. It's a shorter kick. Fielded by Williams at the 15. He gets past the 20, past the 30.
Nice little
down at
back.
The 35. Yeah, good little running back there. Take 2:17 and counting left in the game. So the black shirts hope to score. They have to move pretty quickly here.
First down in the black shirts.
Jimenez back, still in his quarterback here.
Waukesha West is taking the lead over Arrowhead 17-15.
Waukesha West is leading Arrowhead 17-15.
Close game there.
Yeah.
Kettle Moraine leads Oconomowoc 28-6.
Kettle Moraine leading Oconomowoc 28-6. Kettle Moraine is our guest next Friday night. So, twin receivers both sides. Dunlop on Ben's left. He gives a Dunlop. Good little run there by Dunlop. Powers his way for a first down. Good little run. Nice design play there on the spread. Black shirts hustling back to the line here. Nope, they're going to huddle real quick. Some different receivers now. Now in for the black shirts.
Dunlop showing his speed.
Javon
there.
Carter, number 23 in. Twin receivers both sides. Dunlop on Jimenez is right. Ball on the right hash. High snap. It's going to go to Dunlop again, this time going to his left. Some good blocking, pushes his way forward, and close to another first yard, an 8-yard gain for Isaiah Dunlop. 56 seconds and counting, so black shirts have to hurry here. But I like what I'm seeing from the running game. Ball at the 46-yard line of Buck, 43 and counting. So here we go. Twin packages both sides. Pistol formation now for Jimenez. 34 seconds and counting. The snap. The man is back. Looking deep. He's got some room. Runs out of the coverage. Goes wide. Great little pass. And it's caught.
He caught it.
At the 29-yard line. 19 seconds and counting. Call timeout here.
Number 10, Tyler Williams.
They're not calling timeout here. 13 seconds and counting.
Tell him to keep going.
Wow. Twin packages both sides. This should be the last play of the game here. They're probably going for the end zone. Yep. And Amanda's looking deep, going for the end zone. And there's interference. No interference call.
You're saying no interference.
That'll do it.
Well, that's a wrap.
So the final score, the black shirts lose to McGonigal 55-0 as the teams meet at midfield for the hockey line to congratulate each other on a good game. Again, black shirts are back here at Hollop Stadium next week to take on Kettle Moraine, Drew Wagner and the boys. And don't forget to join me tomorrow morning. Mayor Sean Riley and Water Utilities are Dan Dukniak will be my guest. The fun starts at 8. Black shirt football brought to you by Mia's. And we are also doing our inaugural broadcast of Carroll University. Coverage starts at 5:30 at Schneider Stadium for the second annual Quick Trip Bowl, the season opener and home opener for the Pios taking on the Warriors of Wisconsin Lutheran. So we'll see you then. And thanks again for joining us. And remember, safety is everyone's responsibility. Bye for now and see ya.
If you've been searching for authentic, made-from-scratch American Italian cuisine, visit Mia's of Waukesha. Mia's skilled chefs craft every dish with freshness and love, bringing you the true essence and flavor of American Italian classics. Open daily Wednesday through Sunday at 800 Clinton Street in Waukesha. Walk in or call to reserve a table. 262-547-6503. That's 262-547-6503. Or log on miasofwaukesha.com. It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Kroot. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
It's back to school time, but before we ring the bell for class, how about this subject? The first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created America's first kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown, about 50 miles west-northwest of Milwaukee. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Bach.
Tony Barrett.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
They swipe the two seats. Well, what are the consequences? Well,
AM radio provides always-on news, sports, talk, traffic, and weather reports. It also delivers vital emergency information when your community needs it most. A new bill in Congress would ensure AM radio stays in your car. Because when cell and internet services are down, this free emergency service is critical. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
Folks, I tell you this much, the Kripescast is just the butter on my cheese.
Cockroaches, not that bad. They call them palmetto bugs in South Carolina. Same thing, you can call them up here.
Are they really palmetto bugs? Yes.
Yeah, and they're a great source of protein. They're Did going you know to be that? The lobsters of the future.
They also got salmonella, and they can lay like 40 eggs at once.
Well, they gotta work out a few kinks there, okay? They gotta work out a few kinks.
Kripescast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
Attention high school sports fans, are you an armchair official? You know, the parent or fan who constantly yells at the referees and loves to let everyone know just how bad you think they are. Well, if you think you could do better, then get in the game and prove it. It's time for you to suit up and make the calls where they actually count. Every sport in Wisconsin needs more officials. Sign up today at highschoolofficials.com.
You've heard the word a lot lately, but what does it mean to be arraigned? The Department of Justice describes it as the first court appearance for someone facing criminal charges. A judge reads those charges, then the accused enters a plea. At the end of an arraignment, a trial date is set along with bond. And depending on the severity of the charges, the judge can add conditions to take away the defendant's weapons or passport before being released. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
If you've been searching for authentic, made-from-scratch American Italian cuisine, visit Mia's of Waukesha. Mia's skilled chefs craft every dish with freshness and love, bringing you the
And I think that's stuff that has to be pointed out as well. The entire 20th century is on the chopping block.
Every single worker safety, job protection, union protection law is going to be on the table. They now have a home court advantage, a home Supreme Court advantage, and they're going to win every single time. Corporate America.
Well, what do you say to this?
Undermine those rights.
What do you say to the argument? Look, you know, Senator, you know, the Republicans just played the game better. They out-organized, they out-funded, they for decades have funded right-wing think tanks and media outlets and, the Federalist Society. They've got the infrastructure to build this juggernaut. They've just done it better. What do you say to that argument?
I say that we've got to do it better ourselves. That's why we have to expand the court. Now, people say, well, that is unseemly. We shouldn't do that. My answer is, when bullies steal your lunch money down the schoolyard, if you don't do anything about it, they're going to come back over and over and over again stealing your lunch money. So we've got to fight back. And the way to fight back, the way to stand up to bullies is to expand the court, to take back control that legitimately belongs in Democratic hands.
Now, what's interesting to me, and I had a conversation a couple of years ago with a conservative who told me, you know, actually it was the night that Trump was elected, said it's going to be interesting watching liberals become states' rights people and people learning just how important the Supreme Court is. And this was well before a lot of this stuff was in the headlines. And you look today, the anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision. You go in a couple of weeks, you're going to have the Loving anniversary of the Loving decision. All of this stuff that we take for granted, that's popular in the public, that people want, this court could conceivably overturn in the coming years, as weeks, months, and years, as you pointed out.
We went 100 years after the Civil War thinking we had a 14th Amendment, a 15th Amendment. Thinking that we had a right to vote for all blacks in our country. Didn't happen. It took Martin Luther King Jr., took people like Thurgood Marshall being put on the Supreme Court, who was the lead lawyer in Brown versus Board of Education, by the way, in 1953, in order to begin to implement what the promise was of the Civil War in terms of protecting the rights of minorities in our country. So, that's something that really sticks in the craw of these very conservative, especially red state Republicans who want to go back to a time before the civil rights movement. And so if we're not going to fight, then we're going to betray the legacy of all of those who stood up in the 50s and 60s in order to expand procedural and substantive due process in our country. And so that's our challenge right now, generationally. We're up. It's our time. We have to fight the same way that those great leaders in the 60s fought.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Senator Ed Markey. You want to check out his website, markey.senate.gov. We'll get links out on social media, how you can do that and maybe get involved in pushing. Don't be agonizing. Organizing. It's what we need to be doing. Now, here's the thing. You've been in the Senate for a number of years. You've been in government for quite a number of years. We keep hearing this word conservative being thrown out. These are not my grandparents' conservatives. These folks right now are radicals who want to completely change the face of this country into a corporatocracy or an oligarchy, however you want to frame that. And I think it's important that we start calling this kind of stuff out in very loud ways.
Exactly right. Conservative really means, in the traditional sense, that you respect precedent. You respect what has happened in the past. All we have to look at is the Dobbs decision. You're repealing Roe versus Wade. That was a 49-year-old precedent that our country had come to accept as the law of the land. But Alito, all of them, they really don't care. It was pre-packaged. They were going to repeal it. And there's a lot more that they're going to repeal as well. It's on the agenda, actually. Justice Thomas, in his concurring opinion with Alito on the Dobbs decision, said that, yeah, we should also be talking about contraception and access to contraception as well. It's just crazy. It wants to go back to 1958, wants to go back to a time before all of these rights had been kind of enshrined into our constitutional framework by the courts of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and on. So it's a historic challenge. There's never been a time like this. It's an illegitimate Supreme Court. The Federalist Society has handpicked these judges, and they're going to go systematically through every single area of American life, pull up a case from below, most likely from southern states, from Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, and then they're going to rule 6-3 to repeal a statute under which we've lived for generations.
You brought up Clarence Thomas. The joke has always been, and for years of the Roberts Court, that they're bought and paid for by big moneyed interest. We're now finally seeing in public that, I guess what I've learned from Clarence Thomas is I've got the wrong friends. I've never had anyone buy me real estate or take me on $500,000 vacations or pay my kids tuition. This to me is a real problem that is still not being addressed. Is there a way forward on holding these justices accountable, even while we're talking about expanding the court?
Well, I believe that Justice Thomas should resign, obviously. And I believe that there should be an adoption of a real code of conduct on the Supreme Court. And if they don't, I believe that Congress should impose a code of conduct on them.
Here's the thing, Senator. Here's my problem. This idea that I didn't know how to fill out the form, or I was told I didn't have to. If I fill out a government form improperly, if I make these statements, bad things happen to me. And look, I'm not a Supreme Court justice, But saying that the forms, well, were seems like a reach to me, where the average everyday working person is going, hey, there'd be consequences for me if I did this, probably going to jail. Why doesn't it apply to someone like Thomas?
Precisely. So we are, thanks to Justice Thomas and his wife, Jeanne Thomas, we're in that discussion, really a needed discussion in our country. And I think that we can give them, you know, the opportunity to put together their own code of conduct at all of the federal judiciary levels below the Supreme Court. There is a code of conduct. And if they don't, I think it's time for us to have that debate.
No, and the other part of this is, I'm sure you saw the CNN Trump thing that was happened the other day, the town hall, where Trump came out and admitted, hey, that Roe thing, I did that. I'm the one who overturned Roe because I got you three justices. Is there a moment where we go, you know, all three of those people came and perjured themselves in front of the Senate? Because I got to assume that they made it for Trump to make that kind of claim. He had to have assurances that these folks were on the right page.
Well, look, at people think that Supreme Court justices serve for life, but actually they serve for good behavior. The problem is to remove a justice would require, two-thirds most likely of the Senate in order to accomplish that goal. At this particular point in time, that's not going to be possible. Yeah. What will be possible is for us to inject all of these issues into the 2024 election cycle so that everything is on the table and the Supreme Court will be the ultimate arbiter of whether or not those rights, those protections for all Americans and all aspects of their lives are protected. Especially, my father was a union guy. My father was a local vice president of an electrical union. He used to hold up his finger that got cut off when he was a young man working in a factory, and he'd go, Eddie, that was before OSHA, you know? That was before OSHA. Then he'd have another finger that he'd use in order to describe how he felt about pre-OSHA, pre-labor protections that were put on the books. All of it, all those safety laws, all those wage protections, all of those, you know, are all going to be on the table at the Supreme Court. So we can't, as you said, we can't agonize. We have to organize.
Yes, sir. You know, it reminds me of an interesting story. Last summer, we did a Working Class Heroes radio tour, and we were up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and we went to one of the coal mine tours. And the guy was talking about the working conditions there and how, you know, they were working in knee deep of muck and feces and horrible stuff. And the conditions were just deplorable. And a woman behind me goes, where was OSHA? Because we've become so accustomed to having these things that people never understood or never dawned on her that there was a before OSHA, which I found very interesting. Last line of questioning I've got for you, because on the labor rights front is where I spend most of my time. I've been saying since Roberts came around that their goal is to take us back to the Lochner era, to where if you're desperate enough and hungry enough to work for poverty wages, in deplorable conditions, hey, that's your freedom. That's your liberty to go and do. And I see incrementally us moving back that way. Janice took, you know, union rights away from the public sector workers. Concepcion did the whole forced arbitration stuff. There's case after case after case going against working people. I don't know that we spend enough time talking about that. I think that's something we should be really highlighting more.
My father always used to say, Eddie, you can't beg for your rights. You got to take them. You got to fight for them. So everyone should understand it's all on the table with the Supreme Court. Every June from now until we expand the court are going to be ripping away these rights, yeah, these protections.
So what do we do? What's the marching order? What do we do tomorrow? What do we do right now?
We need a Democratic House. We need a Democratic Senate. We need to keep Joe Biden in. Then we need to expand the court. We can do it if we construct that. And so that means 2024 decision time. Because this illegitimate far right wing Supreme Court is aiming at every one of these rights and protections. And because it's corporations that created this entire Heritage Foundation, Leonard Leo world out there, they're principally aiming at the protections which workers have received from corporations over the years through legislation or through court decisions. So it's all on the line. And I just hope that your listeners understand this. This is the moment, the existential moment. We have to keep Joe Biden. We got to get back four, five more seats in the House, hold on to the Senate, and then let's just do what needs to be done. We cannot allow the bullies to continue to take our lunch money. We got to fight with the same intensity, the same passion that they do. And your listeners are those people. They are the workers. They are the fighters. They are the people who know that the unions built the middle class in our country. And right now, the Supreme Court is intent on taking away all of those protections, all of those guarantees that have been put on the books over all of these past decades.
Senator, I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts with us down the line. And best of luck getting this through, something we desperately need. Thanks so much.
Love being with you. Thank you. Thanks for what you do.
Senator Ed Markey. Check out that website, markey.senate.gov. We'll get links out on social media. I can do that. Can take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk. Thanks for tuning in to the Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at therickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I want to get to a couple of quick emails. Carl, listening on KTNF in Minneapolis, says, Rick, I didn't hear you once mention Carl Clarence Thomas and all of the ethical scandals he is involved in. Doesn't this alone render the court illegitimate? And look, as I said, you know, if it were any one of us, if it were you, if it were me, if we screwed up these forms, if we just said, you know, hey, someone told me I didn't have to, they'd feed and house and clothe us. That's what they would do. The reward for doing that would be a residence. It'd be small, cramped. You'd probably have a roommate, but you know, you three hots and a cot. There's no chance Thomas is going to be held accountable for all of the stuff that he's done. And I don't know what reasonable person looks at what Clarence Thomas did and say, oh, that's okay. I don't know that how he can justify it. Understand, you know, I don't know how you go, yeah, I took a $500,000 vacation because he's my buddy. He's my friend. He you know, lets me use his yacht whenever. You know, it's kind of like your neighbor letting you use the yard rake. Same thing, you know, multi-million-dollar yachts, you know, leaf blower. Same thing, you know. It's just how it is. But then again, my neighbor never paid for my kids' tuition either. Never bought real estate to improve. I mean, there's so much here that you go, how could anybody look at what Thomas has done and not say he's got to go? And his wife is a whole nother monster story. The hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that have been funneled to her from these right-wing groups. I know. As I've been told, it's this incestuous pool in which they live. They're not buying their access. They're treating their friends well. They're good friends. They want to see their friends do well. Now, look. The Supreme Court situation we're in, you can thank the organization. And I keep coming back to this, and Senator Markey brought it up too. Leonard Leo and the Federalist Society and the organizing that conservatives have been doing, big moneyed interests have been doing for decades. From high school, from you know, first year in college, all the way through law school, creating an environment where they're grooming the next justices. The next people who are going to sit on the bench. It's all about feeding. It's all about feeding them. And very, very well. I guess, you know, look, who could turn down a $500,000 vacation? I had someone ask me, would you turn it down? I'm like, no, of course not. Am I an idiot? But there's a difference between me, a guy sitting behind a microphone on the radio, and a sitting U.S. Supreme Court justice who has the hopes, the dreams, the legitimacy, the faith of 350 some million people. And he's betrayed them. Seems simple. Brian also sent me an email, said public trust in the institution of the Supreme Court has been plummeting. Combine their decisions on voting rights, money and politics, and then taking away Roe with the attempted insurrection and Trump saying he's going to pardon the insurrectionists if reelected. This feels like it's an aspect of a larger slide towards extremism in this country. Do you think? We've been seeing this kind of extremism. You know, if you go back to 92 and you go, you know, Pat Buchanan's speeches were better in their original German, that was kind of a slide away from, you know, conservative thought of the day. We have jumped the shark again and again and again. This is like a hurtling of the sharks of how far this Republican Party has gone from even the Buchanan era. So this idea that the court has legitimacy left, sorry, I'm not buying it. So how do we save it? A conservative would tell me, got to kill it. That's what my conservative friends say. You got to kill it to save it. Much argument about Social Security. The only way we can save Social Security is if we change everything about it. Destroy it all. What do you think? I got to tell you, I don't have great hope for this court. And unless we get our heads collectively around the idea that elections matter, because I remember the 2016 election. I remember walking the line of voters ready to vote and having conservative after crazy MAGA hat wearing nutcase tell me it's all about the Supreme Court. Don't care about any of Trump's problems. It's all about the Supreme Court. Why? Because they knew. They had been trained by right-wing media to understand the court is where the power is. Changing the laws to justify your crimes, that's where the power is. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day the Delano grape strike began in California. The strike came a year after activists had forced Congress to end the Bracero contract labor program. The Filipino Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, led by Larry Itilong, Philip Vera Cruz, and others, called the strike against the Delano growers and the Coachella Valley grape growers. It had been a record harvest. Farm workers demanded higher wages, humane working conditions, and union recognition. When the growers refused, thousands walked out of the fields. A week later, the Mexican-American National Farm Workers Association, led by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, joined the strike. It was a historic moment. Within a year, the two unions would merge to form the United Farm Workers. The union sent strikers to the Oakland docks to persuade the longshoremen not to load non-union grapes. Many of the Filipino workers in the San Joaquin Valley worked in the Alaska fish canneries organized by the ILWU in the off-season. And so the ILWU honored their union brothers' request. Thousands of cases of grapes were left to rot on the docks. This initial victory led Chavez to organize a grape boycott against heavyweights DiGiorgio and Shenley Industries. 6 months into the strike, union leaders marched 300 miles from Delano to Sacramento to bring attention to their struggle. They hoped to pressure growers to the negotiating table and legislators to act on their behalf. For 5 years, the strike and boycott continued with marches, organizing, and picket line arrests. Gradually, the UFW began winning higher wages, union recognition, and hiring halls. Finally, in 1970, a collective bargaining agreement covering 10,000 workers was reached.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
We human beings sometimes do some terrible things in pursuit of the almighty dollar. But to our credit, one moral line we humans don't cross is to profiteer by gouging sick people on the price of medicines their lives depend on. Unless, of course, you count executives of giant pharmaceutical corporations as human beings. Gouging patients is their preferred business model. It's a scream, then, to watch Big Pharma fall into a sky-is-falling fit over our government's long-overdue move to give us patients some bargaining power over this monopolistic industry. Under President Joe Biden's anti-inflation policy passed earlier this year, our Medicare program can now negotiate drug prices on our behalf. This will drastically lower what you and I are now forced to pay to the profiteers. For decades, Congress has coddled the corporate gougers, who maintain by far the largest lobbying army in Washington, allowing them to manipulate the patent laws and rig the system. Thus, we Americans pay 2 to 3 times more than people in other countries for the exact same medicines. Oh, whale drug executives, bloated profits give us the incentive to keep developing innovative new cures. Hold it right there, Slick. Most basic drug development is done by tax-funded medical researchers, not brand-name market hucksters. Mega drug outfits like Johnson & Johnson, Merck, and Bristol-Myers spend more on advertising, exorbitant executive salaries, lobbying, and big stockholder payouts than on research. Still, these same greed hounds are suing Biden, howling that making them negotiate is an unconstitutional taking of their income. But hello, these scoundrels have been taking our income, health, and lives for years. This is Jim Hightower saying, I'm with Biden on this. To stay informed and involved, connect with Public Citizen at citizen.org.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, some good news coming out of the Pennsylvania State House. They recently passed a minimum wage increase, 103 to 100. Actually got a couple of Republicans to come over and say, yeah, maybe working people do need an increase in their wages. The minimum wage will go up to $15 an hour in 2026. As I understand, this is going to peg to inflation, so we won't have decades of, or a decade plus of the minimum wage being eroded by inflation. Also, the tipped minimum wage going to be 60% of the minimum wage, also to be pegged to inflation. This is important, and it passed the House. Good thing. Now, is it going to get through the Senate? I'm here to share some thoughts on if it's possible to get this bill through the Pennsylvania State Senate. I've asked Pennsylvania State Senator Art Haywood to come give us some thoughts. Art, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for allowing me on. Yeah, we got a tremendous opportunity to raise the wage in Pennsylvania based upon what the House has passed.
And what do you think the chances of that are going to be, given the fact that Republicans overwhelmingly control the state Senate?
So it is an uphill battle, but a couple of things are in our favor. Number one, State Senator Dan Laughlin, Republican from Erie, has proposed a similar bill, not exactly the same, but similar, getting it to 15. So I think that's good news for us. The second piece of good news is that we have 2-1 those who want to see it. We've got the governor wants to see it go up. We've got the House that wants to see it go up, and those are advantages. Now, there are negotiations ongoing now, and as a result of those negotiations, there's no outcome yet. One thing I will say that I see is a challenge around the Commonwealth that, let me describe it as follows. So we know that Pennsylvania is the last in the nation in terms of the wage rate. We know we're surrounded by states with a higher wage. It's up to 14 in New Jersey, getting ready to hit 15, same in New York. On the other hand, West Virginia's at 8.75, Ohio's at 10.10. And so those in the West are looking to Ohio and West Virginia for a standard. Those in the East are looking for New Jersey and New York. So we've got a big tension here that I hope we can favorably resolve.
Now, once the House passed this increase, and look, I'm 100% behind it, immediately all the naysayer groups, the Commonwealth Foundations and the employment opportunity groups and all of them were immediately out saying, this is going to cost us jobs, Art. We're going to lose thousands of jobs. It's going to be those tip jobs, those restaurant jobs, those service. They're going to all be gone, Art. It's going to be the end of public sector work.
Yeah, we hear these myths over and over again. And what I tell people to do is, first of all, just look to New Jersey. Just look to New York. These are all states that are going to 14 an hour. These are all states where there's no reports of jobs lost, folks are not getting paid anymore. And so while there's all these theories about what might happen, there is a reality of what happened. And that is in New York, that is in New Jersey, all the states that surround us. There's no job losses being reported. I want to share one other thing. Raising the minimum wage is really good for businesses. And it's primarily so because low-paid workers will get the money and typically spend it in the neighborhood where they live and work. I say to people, business owners, would you rather have someone come to your store with $100 to spend or $200 to spend? All business owners said they would rather have people with $200. So doubling the minimum wage will create exactly that result, doubling the amount of money that consumers have to spend, and that is really good for business.
But, you know, again, it comes back down to this idea, which side are you on? Are you on the side of the people who work for a living, or the side of the corporate interests who put, or it's all about putting more profit into their pockets? But we hear all the time that this caring for the small business owner, we care about, you know, the mom and pops. You know, can you speak to a little bit to this? Because, you know, look, I look at a lot of the low wage jobs. These are big corporations. These are people who are, you know, the fast food industry. You see a lot of the wages being suppressed. Can you speak a little bit to what this would do to the mom and pops in your view?
Sure. And I also want to share that often the big businesses try to hide behind the very small businesses and pretend that they are going to have the same level of suffering or challenges as small business. And we know that's not the case for any of these national, multinational companies. They can afford it. Second thing is, across Pennsylvania, wages have been going up for small, medium, and large businesses. This is because of the competition. And so now some businesses are paying $16, $17 an hour. And unfortunately, though, some individuals have been left behind, which is exactly why we got to raise the minimum wage. Let me go straight to the point of the mom and pop. So small businesses in New Jersey, mom and pops in New Jersey, surviving. Mom and pops in New York, surviving. Mom and pops in Ohio, surviving. So all of these small businesses that are rightly concerned about this change can look to where the wage has raised and see the experience. And more money that people have to spend, this is an easy equation. The more people that have to spend, the better it is for small businesses, mom and pops, big business, middle-sized businesses. So the increased income from sales should have a big benefit. The second big benefit that we often repeat is turnover. And small businesses, mom-and-pop businesses, often have a lot of turnover because of the wages that they're paying. What has been consistently found is that a higher minimum wage helps to reduce turnover. And turnover is a cost to all businesses, big and small.
It sounds like there are a lot of really good reasons to raise the minimum wage. But all I keep getting from my friends on the other side is the fear. We're going to lose jobs. And can you talk a little bit to the studies that may have been done in places like, Seattle, where they have raised the minimum wage, and what effect that had on? Because it's my understanding that when you raise the minimum wage, there's actually a slight increase in the number of jobs that are produced instead of the doomsday that's been thrown around that we're going to lose a quarter of all restaurant jobs because of this. Can you share a little bit on that?
Yeah, no, there have been a number of studies, and Seattle is one of the places which has been studied a lot because they went to $15 more quickly than any other place. And what was discovered from the Seattle study is A, there was no job loss. B, there was some job gain. This job gain is very fundamental. The more money people have to spend, the better it is for the economy, the more the economy grows because there's more sales. And that is the most fundamental economic approach that is out there. People spend money. You have to produce more. So to respond to demand of what people are buying, and that grows the economy, grows jobs.
Yep.
So that's the most simple explanation I can give the people.
Sounds like common sense.
In terms of what happens.
No, I mean, it sounds like common sense. I mean, the reality is the more money working people have in their pockets, the more they're going to spend, and the more that business is going to work to get that money. It seems like a positive direction. It seems like, you know, a growing economy, as opposed to we're going to restrain how much money people have in their pockets and you know, make them struggle and suffer and not be able to afford the things they need. It just seems like common sense.
Yeah, it's most often that's right, Rick. It's most often called the virtuous circle, which is the more money individuals, working people have to have, then it pumps more money into the economy, and that is the virtuous circle that we get when we make sure everyday people have a decent standard of living. That's on which the economy is based.
There you go. I hope folks will in Pennsylvania, in our Pennsylvania audience, reach out to your state senator, say we need to get this done. We need to get it done soon. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Pennsylvania State Senator Art Haywood. You know, Art, I saw the House has passed a couple other pieces of legislation I wanted to get your thoughts on.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in this country, medical debt is a huge thing. In fact, you know, someone sent me a graph of, you know, the number of people who have to file bankruptcy every year because of medical debt, and it was some obscene number, like, you know, 700,000 people a year, whereas in other countries, you know, like Britain, France, Japan, Germany, nobody files because of medical debt because they have a national health care system. I understand our House has passed something that would help prevent and help provide relief from people with medical debt. I'm curious your thoughts, if you have any thoughts on House Bill 78.
Yeah, I think it's the right direction in which they had the Affordable Care Act from Obamacare was also in response to the high level of bankruptcy that individuals are having to endure because of medical debt and medical bills. So this is going, in my opinion, it's going in exactly the right direction to relieve individuals from some of these high costs from hospitals and physician care. Now, I will say in terms of prospects in the Senate, I think that's going to be a little more challenging, at least to get it done quickly, because we haven't had really any hearings on it or a whole lot of discussion on it. So it may take the Senate more time to get comfortable with this kind of relief. But this is the right direction. This is a kind of reasonable relief that people deserve.
I'm there. And this is one of the reason I bring this up, and I know this is going to be a heavy lift to get past the Senate. Just like I know that the House Bill 1050 to keep preventative care free in health care plans here in Pennsylvania, probably going to be a heavy lift in the Senate. I think these are important campaign issues. I think these are important issues to bring to people and say, look, which side are you on? And then which side are your elected officials on? Because, you know, for too long, we've been letting people off the hook. You know, families are struggling. Families are having a hard time with health care, with education. You go through the struggles, and I think we have to show which side people are on.
Yeah, and I think that is exactly what the House Democrats are doing, and we will do as well. They are demonstrating consistently that they are on the side of everyday people, on the side of everyday people with respect to pay, on the side of everyday people with respect to health care bills. They also passed legislation I started in the Senate to increase the ability of people to save for retirement with automatic payroll deduction. These are all bills directly related to improving the everyday life of Pennsylvanians. And there is a tremendous contrast because the Senate does not yet appear to be willing to do so. Now, I say not yet because we're not done, but if the Senate doesn't align with these important initiatives, we will know where they stand.
Yep. Last question I've got for you. Being from the Philly area, pretty incredible work done on the I-95 bridge. I got to give Governor Shapiro an enormous amount of credit. I thought someone finally did what I've been calling for and start taking credit for stuff. I loved the live cam. In fact, we've used it on the show a number of times. But can you talk a little bit about what it took to get that done and with that moving?
It was amazing. And Rick, I watched the live cam as well some evening. So I give tremendous credit to the leadership of Governor Shapiro to create the direction, create the demand, and get everybody organized in the same direction and do it quickly. I also want to really put a shout out to the union workers in the building trades who were the ones to execute it, to get the work done. Without the building trades, it would not have been done so quickly. You need those individuals to be willing to work 24/7. That's also what it took. But I give Governor Shapiro a tremendous amount of credit to get that temporary road up. It is used for Philadelphia, but not just Philadelphia. The whole Northeast Corridor, trucks were being delayed, deliveries were being delayed. And so it was very important for our overall economy to get that road up and up again. And you really got to give them a lot of credit. I said to my wife, John Shapiro is now America's governor, having gotten I-95 back on track so quickly.
No, it showed what this shows me. And again, you know, I've been talking about this, you know, since the reopening. It shows that we can do big things. When we take off the red hat and the blue hat and we get a hard hat on, we can accomplish good things. And this just shows that when we put, you know, some of this nonsense aside, we can do good things.
I think it will help us raise our aspirations in terms of what we can be in the Commonwealth, what we can be as a nation, and who we can really be. And raising our aspirations, I think, will go a long way in dealing with the prior conversation you had about the status of the former president. Once we can really see that we can be much better than what some of this leadership is selling us, then I think that can help us get beyond those who are trying to drag all of us into the gutter.
I'm right there with you. Senator Haywood, I appreciate your time. Keep up the great work in the Senate, and let's get that minimum wage done. I hope folks will reach out to your office and to others to push in the right direction. If you want to see the minimum wage increased, call your state senator in Pennsylvania and tell them, hey, we need to do this. But, Art, I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Rick, and thanks for your encouragement.
Good stuff, our good friend Art Haywood. Look, at the end of the day, you want something done, call these people early, call them often, and tell them it's time. Now, do it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around, you'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people, come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1993. That was the day that A.E. Staley locked out 763 workers at their corn processing plant in Decatur, Illinois. Labor management relations grew increasingly hostile with foreign-owned Tate Lyle's decision to bring in new managers. The new management ordered workers to disregard safety regulations. An OSHA investigation found an astonishing 298 violations at the plant, triggering more than $1.5 million in fines. Despite the fines, worker safety concerns persisted. Management proposed a new contract designed to destroy grievance rights, seniority, and worker safety. Even worse, workers would be required to work 12-hour shifts. They would have to be available both night and day shifts at management's whim. 96% of the workers voted to reject the contract. In response, the company locked the workers out of the plant. The locked-out workers were replaced with scabs. As the lockout wore on month after month, and in the face of the employer's refusal to negotiate, the workers had to rely on one another to stay strong. They went door-to-door throughout Decatur to inform the public about what was happening. In 1994 and 1995, the workers were joined on the picket lines by United Auto workers from the city's Caterpillar plant and rubber workers from Bridgestone Firestone. Those workers had gone out on strike as their employers took extreme hard line bargaining positions, earning Decatur the nickname of Strike City. The eyes of the nation were on Central Illinois. It seemed that the Decatur struggle was the stage for the modern labor movement. Workers were fighting back in the age of international mergers and all-out attacks on union workers. 3 days before Christmas in 1995, however, the National Union settled the strike, leaving many of the workers angry with the settlement that took their voice away. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something in your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Rick Scott, Skeletor, Florida senator, evidently doesn't want socialists or communists coming to Florida. He warned that socialists and communists not to travel to Florida. They're not welcome. Okay. How about people who steal from Medicare? Yeah, how about people, how about them? Oh, yeah, that's you. Never mind. Speaking of Florida, a woman who really was, you know, guilty on the face, because she was one of the January 6th people. On social media, she put out, "We breached the Capitol, OMG." Said, "Insurrection is coming. Hold the line. Stay vigilant. Storming the Capitol to take back our country from traitors." She put all this stuff on social media. Now, remember, on the 6th, when all this happened, I remember going on air saying it's going to be interesting to watch all these people who are going to have to go to trial with all of the treason that they recorded. Because these are people who for weeks, days, months were talking about this stuff. And were, you know, very proud of their treason and promoted the fact, like on Parler and other right wing sites. She pled guilty to what she was already guilty of, a felony charge of civil disorder. We'll see what she gets. I'm sure it's not going to be really long because she only spent, I guess, like 10 minutes in the Capitol. But the fact that she went in with the idea that this is an insurrection, it's the mindset that, yes, we're invading the Capitol. And as I said from the beginning, all of those people knew why they were there. Everyone who went to Washington, D.C. on that day went for the express purpose of stopping the certification of the election. It was in the title. It was "Stop the Steal." They believed that they had been cheated. They believed what Trump had told them, that everything was rigged. They bought it. They went believing that they were patriots and they were going to water that tree of liberty with the blood of tyrants and patriots. And their mindset was, we're going to stop the election. We're going to stop the certification of this election, even if it means hanging Mike Pence, to which someone did actually build a gallows. You cannot now say, well, you know, we were just walking through the ropes and it was like an ordinary. Nope. For me, you went there with the intent. And this is what happens to traitors. This is what happens. You went there knowing what you were doing. You bought all in. You thought your guy was going to be behind you and your guy screwed you. And the thing that gets me and it's just mind blowing is that they're going through all this stuff and their guy has done virtually nothing for them. It's quite remarkable. Speaking of the guy, you may remember a guy named Stephen Miller, Trump's top immigration advisor. Well, the big story today that came out is evidently Stephen Miller, who, you know, some have akin to Goebbels or some of the Nazi elite. I'm not going there. But, you know, I got to be honest. The fact that he was... It's being reported that he wanted to, I don't know how you do this. I actually don't. But evidently he was pushing Trump to attack the migrants coming into the country using drones. Literally, you know, using drones. And he wanted to blow up boats full of unarmed civilians who were coming with predator drones. And these, again, these are the very best people. Remember, Trump is only going to surround himself with the very best people. So this idea that, yeah, okay, there's a ship of migrants coming towards the U.S., bomb them. If that comes into your head, if that's a thought, you're a horrible person. There's just no other way of putting that. Look, if you say, yeah, we'll capture them, you know, we'll put them on a boat and send them back, put them on a plane and send them back. If, you know, that, okay, you can think that, but bomb them? Let them drown in the ocean? At your hand? I mean, it's bad enough if you let them, if the boat sinks and you do nothing to help them. That's horrible as well. But the idea that actively gonna bomb them? And it's one of those stories that I read and I'm going, you know, I'm actually not surprised. I'm actually not shocked anymore. And that's one of the things that I guess I'm attempting to deal with, that my level of shock is way out of whack. My level of expectations of others and their humanity is kind of out of whack, and I got to deal with that because there are people.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.